Anyway, although today is going to be more in the nature of a very general introduction, we're going to spend a few weeks trying to look at the book of Mishle, the book of Proverbs, the book of the wisdom of Shlomo that was composed with Ruach HaKodesh. The book of Mishle is a very, very difficult book to learn, really for two reasons, and they're opposite reasons. Sometimes the statements are so obvious that you wonder what's the point of them. Something like, a selfish man is selfish. You know, what exactly is that saying? Or a false witness does not tell the truth. Other times, you're dealing with obscurities. There are many, many repetitions in the book of Proverbs as well. And I don't just mean repetitions in terms of content. Sometimes there is literally repetition of the identical words, which is really almost unparalleled in Tanakh, that within a single book, you have the same pasuk that is stated twice, and even when the words are not the same, sometimes the idea seems to be the same. Also, there's a problem of sequencing. Sometimes the psukim don't seem to be related to each other, which may not be that much of a difficulty. A collection of proverbs, each one can stand on its own. Other times you see a thematic connection. There are a lot of psukim. There's more than 1,000 verses in Mishle, and therefore, as a matter of quantity, it's going to be difficult to know what to cover. So there are many, many problems. Mishle might be a deceptively easy book, relatively easy book, but it is difficult, really, to try to understand the point. And keep in mind as well that the whole concept of a mashal, what is a mashal? Now, the English translation is not quite accurate. The English translation is proverbs. But a mashal is really a parable. A parable, a metaphor, basically in which you are using one thing that is more familiar to describe something that is less familiar. That is a mashal. So, for example, when we describe how HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, we use the analogy of a king. So we say the king is a mashal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, because the very book is called Mishle, that would suggest that every verse has a double meaning, at least a double meaning. There is the meaning of the mashal. What is the statement according to its simple sense? And then there is a nimshal, then there is something else that it is alluding to, and the like. And therefore one has to understand it at least on those two levels, the level of the mashal and the level of the nimshal. So for example, there'll be many, many proverbs. I'll use the word proverbs just as a matter of convenience. There are many proverbs that talk about how to behave in front of a king. And the mashal is true. When you're in front of the president or the queen of England, you got to behave a certain way. And certainly in the ancient world, you better behave a certain way or your head would be cut off. And ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto, the simple meaning, is indeed going to be a true meaning. But at a deeper level, melech can refer to God, or melech can sometimes refer to notzom midei chachamim that are called the kings of the world, man malki rabbanan, that the Rabbanan are called Malachim in different ways. And therefore, one has to look at it in that way as well. Yet another issue, I'm just throwing out some general thoughts here. Another issue in Mishle is the plethora of synonyms to express certain ideas. For example, there are many, many words for foolish people. There's Kesil, and there's Evil, and Pesi, and all sorts of different words that are sometimes seemingly interchangeable, but apparently, just as there are different levels of wisdom, there are different types of foolishness as well. There is limited mental ability, there is impulsiveness, which means you could be a genius, but you have a lack of self-control. There is skepticism and cynicism, which is a type of foolishness, but in a different way, there might be intellectual acuity, but it's moving in the wrong direction. So one has to be sensitive to when are we talking about low intelligence, when are we talking about impulsivity and lack of self-control, when are we talking about cynicism and skepticism and kind of a non-belief in ultimate values and the like. right? And Shlomo HaMelech communicates this, not so much by dictionary definitions. In fact, in Tanakh generally, when you learn Tanakh, how do you figure out, right? We have different commentaries give you differences in synonyms. This word means, connotes this. This word connotes this. Now, there's no dictionary that tells you that. The only way you know it is by examining many, many verses in context, when certain words are used and when certain words are not used, and then you figure out the meaning of the word, right? The meaning of the language arises from the context in which it is used. Now, let me just say at the outset, and this is a general bit of information about Tanakh, that the concept of biblical synonyms, and this comes up a lot of words for fool, a lot of words for wisdom, a lot of words for joy and rejoicing, etc., whatever it would be, many words for crying and suffering. There is a fundamental machlokes among the Rishonim. How do you deal with biblical synonyms? Commentaries like the Ibn Ezra and even the Radak, both of whom were very, very great grammarians. The Ibn Ezra, well, actually both, Radak and the Ibn Ezra, were great, great Balei Diktuk. They took a position which is somewhat surprising because it's not the way we're taught in yeshiva and the like. They took the position that biblical synonyms are simply a matter, or can be a matter, of stylistic, poetic elegance. That sometimes different words are used to express the same idea, because by varying the language and varying the rhythm and varying the number of syllables and the like, that creates a certain beauty and emotional impact on the speaker. But we're not mechuyev to differentiate between simcha and gila and rina and ditza. And this is the phrase that the Rishonim use, kefel ha'inyin b'milim shonot. That it's the same idea expressed in different ways. Right, so according to that, when people ask, you know, people always ask, what's the difference between Simcha and Sason? The Ibn Ezra and the Radak might say, it's a bit of a disappointing answer, because there's not a lot of different terror you can build on it, is, there's no difference, just another way of saying the same thing. Which means, in other words, according to that approach, there is such a thing as synonyms. That's what a synonym actually means. A synonym means the same thing. However, you see from many, many midrashim, going back earlier, that that generally was not the approach of Chazal, that Chazal saw what you might call an omni-significance in every single type of different language, although Chazal don't always tell us what the difference is, but it's implicit in many midrashim that these differences exist. And among the later Mephorshim, they go to a great, great effort to ascribe to each so-called synonym a distinct nuance and a distinct meaning and tone. As I mentioned, the many words for fool sometimes connotes limited mental ability, sometimes connotes cynicism, sometimes connotes lack of impulse control. And this really brings us up to date, so to speak. The two outstanding commentators who go out of their way virtually every single time to differentiate so-called synonyms by giving every word a distinct definition is, number one, is the Vilna Gaon, and number two is a little later than the Vilna Gaon in the 19th century is the Malbim. It's worthwhile to give you a little bit of history. I'm not going to give you the biography of the Vilna Gaon or the Malbim, but just to understand the context of their biblical commentaries. First of all, the Vilna Gaon, it's important to know, the Vilna Gaon's Yahrzeit is on the fifth day of Sukkot. So we just really commemorated his Yahrzeit, Rav Eliyahu of Vilna. Some say his last name was Kramer. Some say we really don't know. They really weren't working with last names so much in those days. The Vilna Gaon, as we know, is one of the most phenomenal geniuses that Klal Yisrael has ever had, and also a person who basically learned Torah 22 hours a day, slept only 2 hours a day, and those 2 hours were never more than a half an hour at a time. In fact, the story goes, he very rarely traveled, although in his youth he did travel throughout Europe. But he once went to a family chasna in a certain city near Vilna, and when he would sleep, it was funny, people would spy on him. They wanted to watch the Vilna Gaon sleep. So they were actually charging people. He was on the second floor of some house. and they had a ladder against the window, and they would charge people a little bit of money that you get 2 minutes to watch the Vilna Gaon. And the story goes that at some point the Vilna Gaon slept 32 minutes instead of 30 minutes. And he got up and he was extremely upset. He said, "I've lost 2 minutes of learning. This is a sleepy city. How can I be in this city?" And it's recorded that the whole city was sad and upset because they took away 2 minutes from the Vilna Gaon's learning. He did not come back to that city for 25 years. 25 years later, he had to be in the city again. And it is recorded he only slept 28 minutes. And he said, "Baruch Hashem, Hashem gave me back my 2 minutes." And the whole city had great, great simcha. So the Vilna Gaon was an extraordinary person. And although one might say he lived a relatively isolated life, but one has to keep in mind that the Vilna Gaon's greatest Talmud was Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who started the world-famous Volozhiner Yeshiva, and all of the yeshivas in Europe, and all of the yeshivas in Israel and in America, and in Europe today, are coming essentially from Rav Chaim Volozhin. So the Vilna Gaon planted the seeds that are responsible for all of the Torah learning virtually in the world. And the Vilna Gaon also revolutionized the approach to Torah learning that prior, I mean, I don't want to say one person did it, but prior to the Vilna Gaon, the approach was much more what was called pilpul, kind of an artificial complexity of connecting things that were not logically really connected. And the Vilna Gaon steered the world of Torah towards pshat, towards clear analysis, and towards definitive halachic conclusions emerging from the Gemara. So his impact on the derech of learning was also very, very strong. And once again, he basically, the whole so-called Litvische culture, which permeated even working class people, in which learning Torah was so important that even the shoemaker, after a whole day of cobbling, would go to the Beis HaMedrash, whether it was to learn Chumash or Ein Yaakov. This really came. The Vilna Gaon created that atmosphere that even the shoemaker, even the coach driver, the balagala, this idea of learning was really part of the Litvische culture. The only public issue that Vilna Gaon actually was involved in, which is a little difficult, was he did fight against the Hasidic movement, which was beginning at the time, and he was an active participant in condemning Hasidus, which he thought denigrated Limud HaTorah, and that's a whole complicated thing. I'm actually giving a shiur at Rabbi Wine's show on some of these in Yonim. And he was involved. He refused. In fact, the one who wanted to meet him was none other than the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rav Shneur Zalman, the Bala Tanya, who was very, very learned in the Shas and Poskim. The Vilna Gaon refused to meet him. And the like. The truth of the matter is, the Hasidic movement did put their best foot forward. That's probably why the Vilna Gaon didn't want to meet him. Meaning to say, there were factions of Hasidus that were not Machshav Torah learning so much. But they sent the great representative who was Machshav Torah learning. But the Vilna Gaon, I think, felt that that would have given legitimation to the other sections of the movement. So he did refuse to meet with the Bala Tanya. In fact, Chabad tells the story that, you know, when the Vilna Gaon was Nifter, on Sukkot, there were some Hasidim who were rejoicing. They said, "This is God's punishment." And the Bala Tanya was so incensed that he wanted to throw them out of the movement totally. He said, "A great, great tzaddik has left the world, and if anything, it's going to be harder for us because he's going to fight us min hashamayim." And the story goes, I think the Bala Tanya himself used to say this story, that when the Vilna Gaon went to Shamayim, he was told that he would go straight to Gan Eden, but he had one chisaron in his life. He had never heard a Hasidish talk. So, as a result, he was given a choice in the Beis Din Shalmala. You must either hear a Hasidish talk, or you will go to Gehenna for 1 second. Or 2 seconds. So the Vilna Gaon said, "I'll take Gehenna." And this is a story. As he's going to Gehenna for 2 seconds, all of the billions of pages of Torah learning became a solid wall. Imagine a billion, millions of pages. And he couldn't get through. So they had to let him off the hook. So the Bala Tanya said, so he didn't get Gehenim and he didn't hear a Chassidus talk either. You know, he kind of won us. It's a Chassidus book. Yeah, this is what they say. Now what's interesting is though, Hashem has a bit of a sense of humor, because you know, what the Vilna Gaon was known as in his lifetime was not Hagon. He was called HaChassid miVilna. Not because he was a member of the Baal Shem Tov's Chassidus, but because he was so pious and righteous in his behavior. He was called HaChassid. This is exactly how his Talmidim referred to him. Now the Vilna Gaon was even greater in Kabbalah than he was in Halacha. And in fact, he wrote very little, because he basically said he could not keep up with his thoughts. He could not write, you know, he was so many different thoughts and associations. But most of what he wrote is in Kabbalah, which is very inaccessible to us in Kabbalah. And the stuff that we have from the Vilna Gaon was largely written by disciples who would listen to him and they would write what he said. The only exception is the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Vilna Gaon wrote himself. That gives the source, and it's very, very brief and very obscure, but the Bir HaGra and the Shulchan Aruch is from the Vilna Gaon himself. There is kimat nothing else. So when you see anything from Vilna Gaon, it is almost always, except if it's Kabbalah, it is almost always second hand. And this is the example of the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Mishlei. The Vilna Gaon, we have a commentary on the Book of Proverbs from the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon was machshiv, both his commentary and the book of Mishlei, very much. You may know, you may have heard over the years, that the Vilna Gaon decided in his mid-years to go to Eretz Yisrael, to leave Vilna and go to Eretz Yisrael. And he wrote a letter to his family, a farewell letter to his family. And in that farewell letter, it's fairly strict because he was going without his wife, without his children, he was going by himself to kind of spend his last years in Eretz Yisrael. And he writes a number of interesting things. He tells his wife and daughter not to go to Shul, because he says in Shul there's so much Lashon Hara and this and that, and you know, just daven at home. It's much, much better. And he talks about the fact that among my lovely Svarim, which I have to leave, he talked about leaving his Svarim similar to leaving his children. He just talked about it that way. He said, I have a book of Mishlei in Yiddish. He tells his wife and daughters, read the book over and over again, for that will bring you to Yiras Hashem and the like. Now, you know the story. He did leave to go to Eretz Yisrael, and mysteriously, he came back without ever reaching the land of Israel. And to this day, there is much, much speculation as to why. Now, he already left Vilna. Why he came back? Why didn't he make the trip? There were Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. It was very small, but there were Jews that were living. Certainly, it was not the poverty that turned him away, because he was living in poverty in Vilna anyway. And another interesting mystery about the Vilna Gaon's trip is that he stopped off in Amsterdam first. Now, Amsterdam is not on the way, really. It's kind of not on the way you'd go to Eretz Yisrael. And people have constructed all sorts of very, very fascinating theories, which may in fact be true, but we don't know. And that is, because the Vilna Gaon was a great, great Kabbalist, he truly was involved in Mashiach and Messianic speculations, it is said that the Vilna Gaon's kavana to Eretz Yisrael was he wanted to bring the Geula. He felt that his presence in Eretz Yisrael could actually bring Mashiach. And he wanted to stop off in Amsterdam because Amsterdam was where Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato had died recently. This is the Ramchal. Now the Ramchal, who most of us know as the author of Mesilas Shesharim, one of the great gems of Musar, was also a phenomenal Kabbalist. In fact, he was a Kabbalist who got in a lot of trouble because he lived shortly after Spinoza. Spinoza was the Jewish philosopher that was excommunicated in Amsterdam for his heretical ideas. And this in turn was shortly after Shabtai Tzvi, the false Mashiach. And in Amsterdam, they knew how to do excommunications. It was not like they put up these wall posters that said they were excommunicating, and nobody pays any attention. In Amsterdam, they have a midnight ceremony filled with candles, and everybody is dressed in black, and they have 400 shofros that they blow. So they really knew how to excommunicate you in that way. And the rabbinate in Amsterdam was really ultra conservative, particularly in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi and Spinoza, and they seriously mistrusted anyone that dabbled in Kabbalah, particularly a young man. Now, although you might say, well, Spinoza had nothing to do with Kabbalah, but essentially, I mean, what's even the connection? Spinoza, if anything, was known as the super rationalist. But still, they kind of lumped together philosophy, Kabbalah, anything that was questioning the simple way of doing things. And as a result, the Ramchal was threatened with excommunication unless he stopped teaching Kabbalah. And it is said that the Ramchal burnt thousands and thousands of pages of Kabbalistic writing. Although we do have many Kabbalistic writings of the Ramchal that are in fact published, but there were thousands of pages that were burnt. In fact, it is said that when the Ramchal would be seized with Ruach HaKodesh, he would be able, this is actually a medical phenomenon, he would be able to write, I don't remember what it's called, but you're able to write compulsively, like thousands of pages, just write, at an extreme speed. And the Ramchal often had that particular phenomenon. Be it as it may, the Ramchal died very young, and the Ramchal, as you know, is buried in Tveria, next to Rabbi Akiva. But the Vilna Gaon very much admired the Ramchal, and it is said he went to Amsterdam to see if he could find some manuscripts of the Ramchal about Geula and Mashiach that he would use going to Eretz Yisrael and bringing the Geula. That might explain the unexpected detour to Amsterdam. But why he came back, we really don't know. Those who argue that he had a messianic agenda basically say that he determined the generation was not yet worthy, was not yet deserving. Others give a prosaic explanation, which is much less dramatic, that because of the Vilna Gaon's Yiras Shamayim, he felt it would have been very difficult for him to fulfill the Truma and the Maser and the Shemitah, and as a result he put his plans on hold because he felt he could not keep the mitzvah Tuluyos Bioretz in the proper way with all of the chumras of the Vilna Gaon. The Talmidim of the Gra is the Vilna Gaon. Gra is Hagon, Rebbe Elio. So we call them the Gra, the Gaon of Vilna. It's all the same thing. They say that they feel that their Rebbe was a reincarnation of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the same way it was decreed that Moshe Rabbeinu could not enter Eretz Yisrael, it was decreed that the Rebbe Elio could not enter Eretz Yisrael either. He was like Moshe Rabbeinu. But, as you know, undoubtedly, and I forgive me if I'm telling you things you know, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, many of them did make Aliyah, and they were the main Ashkenazic component of what was called the Yishuv HaYashan, the old pre-Zionist settlement in Yerushalayim. That is why many of the minhagim of the Ashkenazic minhagim of Yerushalayim are the minhagim of the Gra. Even things like this. In yeshivos and in many shuls, I'll give you a simple example. Friday night, before the Amidah of Ma'ariv, the normal minhag is to say V'shomru b'nei Yisrael es haShabbos. Now, you may notice, I'm not sure, some shuls don't follow this, but if you've davened in some places, you'll notice they do not say V'shomru b'nei Yisrael as a Shabbos. Why don't they say V'shomru b'nei Shabbos? Because the Vilna Gaon held, even in Europe, that these extra paragraphs are an interruption in Ma'ariv, and therefore, when you end with the bracha, Korei Sukkah Shalom, you go right to Shemone Esrei, because you're not supposed to interpolate any of these interruptions. That's a minhag of the Gra. Right? So you didn't even know. People, just like the person who said he didn't know what prose was, but when he's told, well, prose is just, when you talk, it's prose. I've been speaking prose all my life, and now I feel like a poet, poetry and prose. So you didn't even know you were keeping the Minhage HaGra without even knowing it. Or another example. And again, it depends on the shul. Not all shuls do this, but the Yushalmi Minhag is the Minhage HaGra, is on Yom Tov, the Vilna Gaon's opinion was that instead of saying the Shir Shol Yom, let's say Yom Tov is on a Thursday, whether it's Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, so our minog is we say Yom Chamishi, whatever it is. We don't care if it's Yom Tov or whatever it is, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, Tuesday, when we say the Shir Shol Yom. The Vilna Gaon's opinion was that Yom Tov has a special Shir. So if, for example, the first day of Pesach is Thursday, you would not say in Shachris the Shir of Yom Chamishi, but you would say a Kapitel Tehillim that is connected to the idea of Pesach. And this is totally only from the Gra. Every other minhag, both Sfardim and Ashkenazim, is to say the Shir Shol Yom. The minhag Yerushalayim, again, many shuls may not follow this, but the minhag Yerushalayim is you say the Shir of Yom Tov and not the Shir. Now, some people, by the way, one thing leads to another. Some people say this is a misinterpretation of the Gra, because the Gra never meant you only say the Shir of Yom Tov. He meant you say both. So some say the real minhag Gra is to say two, but the minhag of the way people practice the minhag of the Gra is they only say the Shir Shel Yom Tov. So this is because, as I say, there were very, very few Ashkenazim in Yerushalayim. If you go back to the beginning of the 1800s, there were very, very few Ashkenazim in Yerushalayim. The Kehilas were Sfardim, mainly, overwhelmingly. The first major block of Ashkenazim that came were the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. Now, it's interesting, there was also a group of Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. They settled in the Galil, in Sfat and Tveria. The Talmidi HaGra settled in Yerushalayim. Let me give you another example of the Minhag HaGra. In Yerushalayim, and actually in most of Eretz Israel, the Minhag is that Kohanim Duchen, if there are Kohanim, they Duchen every day. Now, as you know, if you remember the old country, in Chutz La'aretz, Kohanim only Duchen on Yom Tov. And even on Yom Tov, only in the Musaf of Yom Tov, not in Shachris, except Simchas Torah, because of drunkenness they duchen Shachris, but the only duchen Musaf normally. Now, Svardim, of course, even in Chutz La'aretz, they do have the minhag of Birchas Kohanim every day. Now, the truth of the matter is, the minhag of Ashkenazim, not to duchen every day, is very problematical. There is a mitzvah in the Torah that when the Kohanim are supposed to bless the people. The Torah doesn't say only on Yom Tov. So where do we get this idea that even if there's a Kohen in the shul, if there's no Kohen in the shul, that's one thing. There's a Kohen in the shul, and we don't fulfill the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim during the week. Why is that so? So the Ramah comes up with a pretty weak reason. And the reason the Ramah says is the following. It's an interesting psychological reason. He says, you know, in order for a Kohen to bless the people, the Kohen must have a heart that's filled with joy. And this is based on a pasuk in Mishlei. Tov ayin hu yivarech. Only one that sees the world in a pleasant way is able to give a bracha. The Ramah says, in Chutz La'aretz, we don't have simcha except on Yom Tov. We're always oppressed and suppressed, and we're broken, and we're not happy, and we're not joyous. Even on Shabbos, apparently, we're not so joyous. Only on Yom Tov do we reach the requisite level of simcha, and that is why Birchas Kohanim is only on Yom Tov. The Vilna Gaon thought that was a weak reason. He didn't like that reason. He says, what are you talking about? Some people are unhappy even on Yom Tov. I mean, what are you going to say? I mean, some people are happy all the time and some people are not happy all the time. Meaning, you can't make a generalization that during the year, you know, I'm unhappy and on Yom Tov I'm happy. Usually it's the other way around. If you're an unhappy person, you'll be unhappy on Yom Tov too. If anything, Yom Tov will make you more unhappy because, you know, it's like Scrooge, you know, everyone's happy. I don't like that. Okay. So because of this, the Vilna Gaon actually paskened in Chutz La'aretz. Not Eretz, in Chutz La'aretz, that you should duchen every day. Like Sfardim. As an Ashkenazi, he paskin that the Sfardim were correct. And the story goes that in his own base Knesset in Vilna, by the way, he was not the Rav of Vilna, one has to keep in mind, he was a private citizen, and in fact, he had to get special permission from the Kahal to keep his private minyan, which had his minhagim, because they were not the minhagim of Vilna. In the great Shul of Vilna, They absolutely did not duchen every day. But he was given permission that he could have a minyan with his Talmidim where he followed his custom. So he was not the posek of Vilna. But the story goes that every time he was about to do it, there was a fire in his Beis Knesset and it burnt down. As if to say, min ha-shamayim, they were ma'akiv him, because Chutz La'aretz didn't deserve the zechus of Birchas Kohanim. So what happened was this. When his Talmidim came to Eretz Yisrael, and they already had many Sfardim who were duchening every day, they essentially said, we will adopt the minig of Sfardim because that is what our Rebbe wanted to do even in Chutz La'aretz. So, in a sense, it's problematical because you can describe it two ways. Why do Ashkenazim duchen every day in Yerushalayim? There are really two different reasons, but they overlap. One is because that was the sheet of the Vilna Gaon who would... In Yerushalayim, Ashkenazim duchen. Yeah. Why do Ashkenazim duchen every day? In Yerushalayim, yeah. The reason is, number one, because that was the sheet of the Vilna Gaon, even in Chutz La'aretz. And number two, that is what Sfardim were doing, so they figured they would adopt that minhag. Okay? Now, that is why, if you go up to Tveria, and you go up to Tzfat, you will see a strange thing. They do not duchen. Now they have a strange practice which does not correspond with anything. They only duchen on Shabbos in Musaf. Now, l'chaira, there is no such minhag that exists. The Chutz La'aretz minhag is only on Yom Tov. And the Yushalmi minhag is every day. Where do you get Shabbos Musaf? The answer basically was, it was a compromised minhag. It's really a very recent minhag. It's a minhag of, the mid-19th century, in which the Hasidim, because in the Tzfat, it was Gil of Hasidim, Hasidim were neither Sfardim, nor did they accept the Vilna Gaon, so they wanted to only duchen on Yom Tov. But there was a lot of pressure that they should follow the Yerushalayim minhag, so they came up with a compromise, which is very, very difficult to fully understand. So the point I'm making is that the Talmidei HaGra had a very, very, very major impact in the spiritual life of Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim, of course, spreads out. Even today, Yerushalayim is spreading to Beit Shemesh and beyond. But in addition, remember, the Talmidei HaGra were instrumental in physically building up. They built Me'ah Shearim, they built Nachal HaShiva, all of the settlements, the early settlements outside of the old city walls, were physically constructed by the Talmidei HaGra. In fact, the president, as you know, the president of the Medina, Ruvi Rivlin, the Rivlin family, the Rivlins, were the great Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. The president is not necessarily totally dati right now, but he is a ben achar ben of one of the great Talmidim of the Gra, who was instrumental in building many shechunot in Yerushalayim, and of course with the financial assistance of Moses Montefiore and the Baron Rothschild. That's why the word Moshe appears in so many neighborhoods. Whether it's Kiryat Moshe, Maskeret Moshe, Yamin Moshe. The Moshe is, of course, Moshe Montefiore, who was a major financial supporter. He came to Eretz Yisrael twice or three times, and the like. And Rivlin, the Rav Yeshua Rivlin, was a big, big builder. And again, what's interesting is, again, it's taking me a little off topic, but it's very fascinating history, that the Talmidim of the Gra wrote about the idea that the Vilna Gaon felt that the way you bring the Geula is not only by spiritually doing Torah and Mitzvahs, which of course is the main thing, but the physical rebuilding of the land and the ingathering of the exiles is that which precipitates the Geula. In fact, it's very, very fascinating that we know that we talk about redemption in two stages. We talk about Moshiach ben Yosef, and we talk about Moshiach ben David. And the Vilna Gaon writes in the Sefer Kol HaTor, I'll discuss that Sefer in a moment, that although these are people, but they do represent ideas as well. And he says, Moshiach ben Yosef is creating the physical infrastructure. Just as Yosef was the one that supplied the grain and the food. And therefore, just as there's a Mashiach ben Yosef before there's a Mashiach ben David, so too there will be a building of the land, there will be an ingathering of exiles, there will be a strengthening of the economy, there will be a cultivation, and all of this is a precursor to the spiritual geula of Mashiach ben David. Now, these ideas are contained in a sefer that the Vilna Gaon did not write, but one of his Talmidim wrote, Rav Hillel of Shklov. Shklov was a city in Lithuania. And this is called Kol HaTor, which is the voice of the turtle dove. And this is based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which describes the Geula as the sound of the dove cooing to us. And as soon as this sefer came out, there was a lot of discussion whether it was authentic or not. There were many Kanaim, there were many anti-Zionists who said this cannot be true because the Vilna Gaon seems to be a proto-Zionist here because he's talking about building the land physically, etc. That can't be so. We have to wait till Mashiach comes to do all these things. So there were many people who said Kol HaTor is a forgery, it's a fake, it's not the Vilna Gaon. And there, Kol, the voice of HaTor, hey, tough, with a tough vav resh, Kol HaTor. You can get a translation online, although it's an absolutely awful, awful translation. But it's largely Kabbalistic. It's not an easy sefer to follow anyway. But the overall thesis is very, very powerful, and it does align the Vilna Gaon with Rav Kook. And indeed, it is very probable that these kesubim, Kol HaTor, circulated in manuscript for over 100 years before it was printed. And not everybody had access to it, but it's very probable that in the Volozhiner Yeshiva, this manuscript was studied. Rav Kook was a Talmud of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, and it did have an influence on Rav Kook's messianic view of even secular Zionism. Rav Kook was a disciple of the Netziv, Rav Natali Fiyut of Berlin, who was the successor of Rosh Yeshiva in the Volozhiner Yeshiva. And therefore the Vilna Gaon... Certainly, I'm willing to venture with some confidence that this type of writing was one of the formative influences in his personality. There's another thing in the book that the Kanaim don't like either, which has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael, that in the book, the Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying that in order to know Torah, you have to have a mastery of all secular knowledge as well. And the Vilna Gaon says, every bit of secular knowledge that you lack will be reflected in an ignorance 100 times in the Torah. So people said, obviously the Vilna Gaon didn't say that, so that has to be a forgery as well. But nevertheless, I think it's been established that this is an authentic repository of the teachings of the Vilna Gaon. And again, there was also a concept. Do you remember there's a famous Gemara about Rabbi Chiya? Rabbi Chiya was one of the great, great early Amoraim, late Tanoim. And Rabbi Chiya had a very fascinating policy. He was once arguing with another rabbi. Another rabbi was saying that he was such a great scholar that if the Torah would be forgotten from Israel, he would be able to reconstruct it with his pilpul and his acumen. Rabbi Chiya said, that might be true, but because of me, the Torah will never be forgotten. And what did Rabbi Chiya do? Rabbi Chiya used to travel around Eretz Yisrael, and he would come to a village where there were orphans, and it mentions that he would set traps, he would capture deer, he would skin the hides, he would write chumashim on the hides, he would teach each child one chumash, he would then leave, so until he would come back, he would do ride circuit, go different cities. Then each child could then teach the other child. So he would teach like children, and each child could teach the other child. And he would go from town to town to town to town to do this and the like. And the Bali Musar say, well, I understand the concept of going to towns and teaching Torah, but why does he have to capture the deer and skin the hide? I mean, let him hire, Goyim to do that, whatever it is. So one of the answers that is given is that when you want your process to be pure, you want every single stage of the process. Now granted, I understand we don't have Rosh Hashiva so much
you know, digging ditches and the like. But this is how the Yishuv was created. This is how these neighborhoods were created. That the Talmidim of the Gra believed that if we want to create a neighborhood of holiness, we have to dig the ditches. We have to put in the plumbing. We have to put in the bricks. That every single stage should be done b'kedusha v'tahara, and that kind of creates a certain atmosphere. And this was the Talmidim of the Gra and Eretz Yisrael. Okay. So be it as it may, apparently Shikolov was a very popular source for the Talmidim of the Gra. The Gra had a number of Talmidim come from Shklov. Some of them were brothers, though, so it doesn't count. And Rav Hillel of Shklov was the author of Kol HaTor, which is the messianic book of the Gra. Rav Yisrael of Shklov is the author of Pa'as HaShulchan, which is written as an addendum to the Shulchan Aruch, giving you the halachos of mitzvos teluyos ba'aretz, which are not in the Shulchan Aruch, although Rav Yosef Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael, fascinatingly enough, but he did not put into the Shulchan Aruch the laws about Shemitah and the like. Pa'as HaShulchan, which literally means the corner of the Shulchan, meaning it's an addendum to the Shulchan Aruch, is Rav Yisrael of Shklov, wrote the mitzvos teluyos ba'aretz, based on the Gra. And then we have a third Shklover, that is Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov. And Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov was the scribe who wrote over many of the Vilna Gaon Shiurim. And among them, he is, this takes us back to our starting point, he is the official author of the Bir Hagra al Mishle. So the Bir Hagra al Mishle is not authored by the Vilna Gaon. The Bir Hagra of Mishle is authored by Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov in his own words. And this does create a certain amount of problems, because there were other Talmidim of the Gra who sometimes said he misunderstood the point, etc. Sometimes it is incomplete, it is elliptical. Certain connections are not always made. You know, we don't know. It's hard for us to know because we simply don't have. Now, it is true that in later years, we did discover an actual Ksav Yad of the Vilna Gaon himself on parts of Mishle. But we have no more than two or three verses, really. Very, 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 very little. Maybe at some point the Vilna Gaon decided he would try to do it himself, but he didn't. At least we don't have it. So really, we do have Menachem Mendel of Shklov, plus some other people who wrote different selections on it. And but as I say, one of the great things the Vilna Gaon does, even in the book in Mishle, even from second hand, is he carefully differentiates all the different synonyms. That's always the case, that Mishle is filled with synonyms, and it is the Gra's position that there's no such thing as synonyms. Now, let me just mention Derech Agav. Well, again, I can tell you so many stories about the Vilna Gaon, but let me tell you one Sukkot story about the Vilna Gaon, which is kind of neat. One of the teachings of the Vilna Gaon was that every person should memorize a tractate. These are, he's talking to his great Talmidim. They should memorize a tractate of Gemara so that when they're walking or traveling and they don't have a sefer, they'll still be able to learn and they will fulfill the mitzvah v'lechtecha v'aderech when you're walking in the way. So there was a bacher or a Talmid who decided that he would learn Maseches Sukkah. And he learned it, and he learned it, and he knew all of Maseches Sukkah by heart. Big accomplishment. It's almost 100 blot. But, this was a bad move, he goes to the Vilna Gaon and says, can you give me a test on the Maseches? Test me on Maseches Sukkah. So the Vilna Gaon says, okay, how many times is Abaye mentioned in Maseches Sukkah? How many times Rabba? How many arguments are there? Now, types of information that maybe in the days of computers is relatively retrievable. But, you know, this is something, and even if you know Masechet by heart, how many times instantaneously, how many times is a certain rabbi mentioned? And the Vilna Gaon was able to do this, not just with Masechet Sukkah, but with every single part of the Torah, the revealed part of the Torah, the non-revealed, the Kabbalah, every single thing. Such a total mastery. And then the Vilna Gaon said the following. He says, how many cases of non-kosher sukkahs are discussed? And how many cases of kosher sukkahs? So he said the following beautiful remez, amazing remez. The word sukkah is spelt in two different ways in the Torah. Sometimes it is spelt with a vav, samach vav, chav hei. That's called male, complete. The gematria of the male, samach vav is 66 and chav is 20, is 86, is 91. Now, sometimes it is spelled without a vav, which is only 85. So the Vilna Gaon says, if you go through Maseches Sukkah, you will find 91 examples of complete kosher sukkahs, and you will find 85 examples of defective sukkahs. Now, to this day, there are commentaries that are trying to figure out the calculation. I mean, this is not self-evident. They're combing through the Masechta. What did he count? What didn't he count? What is called a variation? But this is a Messiah from the Gaon, that the number of kosher sukkahs is the gematria of sukkah male, and the number of pasul sukkahs is the gematria of sukkah chaser. He then said another thing, how even the letters of the aleph beis teach you all the lessons. Sukkah, without the vav, the basic word, are three letters. Samach, chaf, hey. The Vilna Gaon says, an optimal sukkah has four walls. That's a samach. All four sides are enclosed. A less kosher, well, it's kosher, but a less preferable sukkah has three walls. That's a chaf. Chaf is three sides. And b'di'eved, two walls and part of a third wall, that's a hay. So he says the Torah itself in the word sukkah is teaching you the minimum requirements of what a sukkah requires. Right? These were the things the Vilna Gaon said. In fact, another thing the Vilna Gaon said that's relevant to Parshas Bereishis, the Vilna Gaon said, and this is before the Bible codes, that within the language of the Torah, every single event that will ever happen to any individual is actually there. It is there. And not only that, the Vilna Gaon said, every single mitzvah of the Torah is alluded to in the first word, Bereishis. That in the word Bereishis is encapsulated the whole Torah. Now, unfortunately, we don't have any record of all 613, but we do have a record of one incident where one student asked the Vilna Gaon, where's Pidyon HaBen in the word Bereishis? I mean, I don't know where Sitges is, but so the Gemara said, oh, that's simple. If you take the word Bereishis, you can make it an abbreviation. Bereishis, Bechor Rishon, or Ben Rishon, your first son, Achar Shaloshim Yom, after 30 days, Tifteh, you shall redeem. So the Vilna Gaon says, Pidyon HaBen is in the word Bereishis. Now again, I know one down and 612 to go. I know that we don't have a story for every single one. But this was an example of his tremendous genius. Now let me just mention though, that I had mentioned that one of the many, many contributions of the Gra was this understanding that there's no such thing as biblical synonyms. In fact, later, people put dictionaries based on the Gra of this, but the Gra just says the difference in Sason and Simcha, all of these different Lashonos, Evil and Kasil, they all have different meanings. Well, a later Gadol who followed that approach very much was the Malbim. And let me just mention, the Malbim was towards the end, the middle and the end of the 19th century. And what's interesting is, at the time the Malbim wrote, a lot of the Sfarim of the Gra were not yet published. A lot of them were published after, because there were many manuscripts that were not published. And very often, the Malbim is mechaving to the Gra. The Malbim on his own will say the same thing. For example, Megillas Esther. The Malbim's first book was on Megillas Esther. At the time, the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Megillas Esther was not available. And yet, when it became available, we saw that many things the Malbim says, the Gra had said first, but the Malbim was mechaving on his own. Now, it's interesting, if you think about the mid to the late 19th century, which is after the Gra was Nifter. The Gra was Nifter at the beginning of the 1800s. This was also the rise of the Reform movement. And you know, the Reform movement did a lot of bad for Am Yisrael,
But I think they deserve some credit, because when the Reform movement went up to Shemayim, I'm not talking about any particular person, and Hashem says, how do you justify all the things you did, you know, for Am Yisrael in a negative way? They say, what do you mean? We're responsible for wonderful, wonderful commentaries on the Chumash. Because many, many commentaries on the Chumash were written as responses to the Reform movement. Such as, I will mention, the Malbim wrote it specifically to combat the Reform movement, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, the Netziv, the Meshech Chachma. The Reform movement can claim pride of authorship of all of these commentaries. Without the Reform movement, there wouldn't have been Rav Hirsch, there wouldn't have been the Malbim. The Netziv perhaps there would have been, but certainly the Malbim and Rav Hirsch were specifically and explicitly written to combat the Reform movement by essentially showing, because again, one of the Reform movement's arguments was that rabbinic interpretation of the Torah Shebaal Peh was artificial, it was strained, it was not real, it did not obey the laws of grammar and syntax, it was simply putting ideas into the text that really did not belong there. This is what the Reform movement initially said. What does Rav Hirsch and what do the Malbim ultimately try to show? They try to show that the drushas of Chazal are actually the inner meaning of the verse itself, based on grammar and syntax and the like. So the Malbim on Chumash is not so much a biblical commentary as it is a commentary on rabbinic interpretation of the Chumash to show how valid it is. But once he moves to Nach, Nevi'im and Kesubim, then he has a different agenda, and that is to show the differences in nuances in biblical synonyms, which essentially, therefore, he was following the Mahalech of the Gra in that way. So what later generations did was, later generations actually compiled from the Malbim and the Gra biblical dictionaries, in which they actually defined the terms. HaKarmel is one of them, in which they define these terms. I saw that more recently somebody did it with Rav Hirsch as well. There's something called an etymological dictionary of biblical Hebrew. And I guess the next step, if you're interested, is somebody should combine Rav Hirsch, Malbim, and the Gra to kind of give you a systematic dictionary of biblical synonyms. Okay, so this is kind of by way of introduction. I do have some more remarks to make, but anyway, it would help people. Again, I have to figure out exactly what we'll cover, but people should bring a mishlei. It doesn't have to be with Mefarshim, just a mishlei. And I'll try to maybe send out to Rivka.